This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Carl Thrush, Assistant Professor of History at the University of British Columbia. Carl is here today to tell us about his book, Native Seattle, Histories from the Crossing Over Place, published in 2007 by the University of Washington Press. Welcome, Carl.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
What led you to write your book, Native Seattle?
Well, partially it's the graduate school thing where you're sort of casting about for a project that nobody else has done, that's kind of a new angle on things. And one of the things I found as I was going through graduate school was that there was this big gap in the history, in the sense that urban history was sort of often one corner and Native history was often another. And I thought that's really odd because growing up in the Seattle area, they seem really closely linked, but nobody in scholarship had ever looked at this kind of question. And in fact, kind of in the American imagination, Native people in cities are at opposite ends of the spectrum. One, you know, represents the future, one represents the past, never the twain shall meet. And so I thought there's a story here, definitely. And once I started digging in archives and talking to people in communities, I realized there's a huge story here.
What resources did you use for your book? Where did you get your information?
From a number of different places. The vast majority of the material comes from archives that are here in Seattle. The University of Washington Special Collections, of course, National Archives in Sandpoint. I did a little bit of research in British Columbia at the Provincial Archives there. One of the chapters talks a lot about Native people from British Columbia traveling to Seattle. And then I did some work in Native communities, or with sources from Native communities directly. The Muckleshoot Indian Tribe was involved in the project, and they offered up some oral histories that had actually never been made public. They were used for court cases or cultural resource projects and so on, and so they gave me access to those, which was really great. And then a woman named Teresa Brownwolf Powers at the University of Washington had done interviews with a lot of Native activists in the community, women in particular from the American Indian Women's Service League, and she gave me access to the unedited tapes of those interviews. So both in those cases, those were stories that this book would have been very different without.
Who were the indigenous people living in Puget Sound when the Denny Party arrived in 1851, and how did they live?
The primary people in what is now Seattle were the Nohto'absh, or Duwamish, that means the inside people, inside referring to the area down toward Renton, the Black River, kind of in off the Sound. And they were the people that were here. There were a couple of different branches of the Duwamish that I talk about in the book. There's a Duwamish proper who are on the Duwamish River and Black River. There's a group called the Shilshulapsh, or the Shilshol, which means the people have tucked away inside, which is the name of the community where Ballard is now. And they were a branch of the Duwamish. And then the Hatju'apsh, which means people of the lake, which were another branch that lived on Lake Washington. And they were really diverse, a lot of different communities connected through trade, through kinship. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that we should think of these communities, all these different villages, really as towns in terms of the way they functioned in their landscapes. These settlements, these large communities of longhouses, were the places where people would come together in the winter, and then the rest of the year they would sort of circulate out through the territories that they had access to for hunting, fishing, gathering of plants, and then in the winters come back to these places. And so they were kind of like towns with hinterlands in ways, just on a smaller scale. And so the landscape here was really densely inhabited. That's one of the things that I really wanted to get across in the book, was how dense this was.
What role did Native Americans play in the first 20 years of Seattle's history?
They made Seattle possible, essentially. That's one of the things I argue in the book pretty strongly, is that Seattle would not have survived as a settlement had it not been for Native people. When the Denny Party and others were coming in the 1850s, the very first years, they survived because of Native people, essentially. We have this image of the Denny Party's landing as being a bunch of white people with a couple of Indians nearby. And in fact, within a month or two, it was, you know, there were 1,000 Native people camped there. And Native people were absolutely central in the early town. They worked in the mills. They worked as domestic servants. There's a great example of a church woman whose memoirs she talks about being able to set up the first Episcopal parish in town because she had a domestic servant, a Native woman who cleaned her house and did her laundry and things, and that made church founding possible. And Native people were really central to the town, and in fact, that caused a lot of anxiety for a lot of civic leaders.
What attitude did the early European settlers have toward the indigenous people they found here?
Pretty mixed. Generally, the consensus was these people are on their way out. This really strong belief in sort of the, quote, the vanishing red man. And of course, that's backed up by this incredible story of epidemics that happened in the region as well. Really enormous mortality in this region, probably about 80% between the 1770s and the 1860s or so. So really enormous. And for a lot of pioneers and settlers, it was that sense of manifest destiny. God is literally clearing the land for us. And these native people, they may be useful for the moment, and it may be very lamentable that they're disappearing, but they are disappearing and the future is us. And so there's varying ranges. And then there's just outright violence and racism. But then there's the more subtle forms of racism, like this idea that native people are inevitably going to disappear. And that was very common as well, particularly among people who wrote their histories. So people like Arthur Denny and other early chroniclers of the city were really invested in this idea that native people are sort of tragic, noble, but doomed.
Would you contrast the native people living here in Puget Sound when the Denny Party arrived with native people who came from other areas into Seattle?
Yeah. There's two different stories here that I wanted to talk about. One are the stories of the indigenous people, the local people like the Duwamish, which is, of course, the obvious story to talk about, and it's the one that most people want to hear about. But I spend about the same amount of time in the book on other native people who came to Seattle. The vast majority of native people who are in Seattle now are not Duwamish. They're Klickitat, or their Choctaw, or their Tlingit. And I wanted to look at the history of that, how that happened. And in fact, as early as the 1870s, there starts to be this kind of hinterland history of Native peoples from far away. So like the Macaw start arriving in Seattle as early as the 1870s, and the city becomes kind of a part of the seasonal rounds of people from as far away as Southeast Alaska, that every year they come through Seattle, they go to the hop fields or the berry fields, they get cash, come back into Seattle, buy stuff, and then go back home. It's a really fascinating story because, in fact, it doesn't really erode cultural traditions necessarily. We might think of these people on the road as losing their traditions, but in fact, on the Northwest Coast, people are buying stuff in Seattle, like phonographs, taking them back to British Columbia and using them in potlatches. So, in fact, visiting cities is reinforcing traditions like the potlatch. It's a really interesting story.
And how did these migrants from other places contribute to Seattle's development?
In the 1870s, 80s, 90s, and very early 20th century, they were really central in a couple of ways. They were part of the urban calendar, which is interesting. You see in the newspapers things like, oh, the Indians are coming. The Indians are here again. There's a sense that in the urban calendar, you know it's a certain time of year when the canoes from the north start arriving. And in the 1870s and the 80s in particular, they did provide actually a lot of influx of cash into the economy. Various documents talk about that these people provide good money. They bring the cash that they earned into town, they buy stuff and then leave. But they also played a really important symbolic role. And again and again, as I've talked to people who remember Seattle from the early 20th century or elders in communities, they talk about the women on the streets of Seattle that are selling baskets and other things that were called curios, but of course are art forms. And that was very much part of the landscape. Frederick and Nelson's, you know, had contracts with Native women who would sell things in the aisles of the store. And there are a lot of photographs of this, and that became part of something you do when you come to Seattle as a tourist. You go look for the Indian women on the streets and you buy baskets from them. And so they performed kind of a symbolic role too. They started to make Seattle, Seattle. These Native women on the streets, they were sort of a fixture of the landscape. And many of them were Macaw or Nechanelth from Vancouver Island. They were definitely part of kind of the urban fabric.
Coming through from the early times to the present, what are some additional ways that both the Duwamish peoples and the people coming from outside have been key in Seattle's development?
One of the things that I tried to do in the book is take things that we think we know about Seattle history, sort of the big stories of Seattle history, and show how they're connected to this experience that I'm calling urban conquest, how they have often at their core the story of the encounter between newcomers and indigenous people. A really good example of that is the debate that raged in the early 20th century and later in Seattle about sort of the open town. Would Seattle be a city where vice was allowed, where there was an official red light district? Or would it be closed? That's one of the huge political issues in the first half of the 20th century. And in fact, that has its origins in the encounter with Native people. In this early period of Seattle's history, when Native people were really central to the town, civic leaders were really anxious about this. And in particular, they really targeted Native women. And the press in the 1870s in particular was really sort of obsessed with Native women as a danger to the city, both morally as well as physically. They're going to burn the place down. They're going to bring smallpox into the city and destroy us all, which is kind of ironic, of course. And so there was this huge debate in the 1870s that came up about vice Native women in the city? Should we quarantine them? Should we ban them from coming into the city and so on? And it absolutely became this debate about the forces of law and order versus the forces of vice. That's the way it was characterized in the press. And later on, the racial piece and the gender piece would kind of drop out of that. But you would still have that debate about, is this an open town or is this a closed town? And it has its origins in Native history.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Carl Thrush, Assistant Professor of History at the University of British Columbia and author of the book, Native Seattle, Histories from the Crossing Over Place. Could you focus on the Indigenous way of life and talk about how that changed as Seattle grew as a city? And in particular, you, in your book, had talked about the challenges for the Native peoples living here who wanted to live in an Indigenous way.
Yeah. One of the distinctions I make in the book is between Indigenous and Indian, and let me sort of get at that. When I think about Indigenous, I'm thinking of the Duwamish people, for example, and this really dense, richly inhabited landscape. One of the things I'm most proud of in the book is an atlas that I worked on with a linguist named Niall Thompson, and it's 127 place names in Seattle and the stories behind each of them and so on. And you get the sense of this really richly inhabited place that's about resource use, spiritual sites, ancestral burial grounds, village sites. It's really rich. And there's kind of that Indigenous landscape. But absolutely central to the story in the book is the transformation of that landscape, environmental transformation. And that really, as you might imagine, put incredible pressure on people who were trying to live in Indigenous ways. And one of the things that I argue is that by the 1920s, Indigenous Seattle is essentially gone. And I'm not saying at all that Indian Seattle was gone. Duwamish people are still in the city. But to live in Indigenous ways, to live in Indigenous places, fishing, hunting, all that becomes really untenable for most of those people. And some end up leaving and going to area reservations like Muckleshoot or Suquamish. Some stay in the city but have to sort of become invisible, right? And many of those people become the modern Duwamish tribe. But the environmental transformations are really critical, in particular the Lake Washington Ship Canal, which destroys the Black River, the straightening of the Duwamish River. Native people are starving to death within sight of the Smith Tower in 1920 as the Duwamish River is being straightened. So it's a pretty, pretty central story to the city, but it's not one that we necessarily talk about.
You have alluded earlier to the idea that Native and urban histories are somehow mutually exclusive, or that this idea has been out there. Why do you think this concept has been present?
It's one of those kind of foundational stories, really, for the continent in many ways. And there's a wonderful illustration. I don't use it in the book, but I use it in my classes pretty regularly, called American Progress. And it's a lithograph from 1872. And it shows this giant woman in kind of this ghostly dress drifting across the plains, and she's trailing telegraph wire behind her, and she's progress, and she has a school book in her hand. And behind her in the sun, in the dawn, you can see a great city with bridges and steamships and so on. And then ahead of her in the disappearing darkness, Native people are sort of running off into the distance and into the dark. And that's really the sense that I think a lot of Americans in the 19th century, but even today, have when you think about Native peoples and cities in relationship to each other, this idea that essentially you can't be Native in the city, that those things are mutually exclusive, that Native people cannot be authentically Native if they're in cities. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. And so I tried to play those things off each other a bit. And I start the book with ghost stories in Seattle, which get at this idea that Native people supposedly can't really exist in cities. And if they do, they're at risk. They're sort of husks. And that's the way they're routinely described in cities. So I sort of start with the idea of ghost stories. Let's get beyond that and look at what people actually did do.
If you look in Seattle, where could Native people and communities be found if you go from, say, the mid-1900s to the present? Just give people a visual idea of, if you came to Seattle, what would you see?
Yeah. Well, in the middle of the 20th century, probably the most visible Native community in the city was the community on Skid Road. And again, here's another big story we tend to talk about Seattle. If you think about Murray Morgan's famous book, Skid Road, Downtown, the world of former loggers and cannery workers, all these old guys that are sort of down and out. And in that community, though, there was a sort of subgroup of people who were Native and who had established a troubled but functioning community in Pioneer Square, First Avenue, and so on. And it was quite different from the rest of Skid Road in that a lot of the community was made up of women. And women played a really critical role as people who shared information. Is there a job available? Where can I stay? And so on. And so Native women played a really important role in this community that had taverns that were referred to sometimes as bow and arrow joints. They were sort of Indian taverns that were safe places, single resident occupancy hotels, and so on. But of course, as you can imagine, it was really troubled. It was a really impoverished community as well. But it's a really fascinating world that disappeared completely. In the 1970s, the Pioneer Square becomes a historic district, and that community gets sort of gentrified out of existence. And the result is sort of the homeless street Indian that we think has probably always existed. It hasn't necessarily. But in the mid-century, those would be the most visible Native people in the city. These people were much commented on by observers at the time as sort of symbols of the inability of Native people to survive in the modern world. And again, that's the kind of story I wanted to get away from and show these Native people building a community, surviving despite being incredibly marginalized and discriminated against and so on.
To what extent were the Native peoples distributed in other neighborhoods within Seattle?
Yeah. I made the mistake of trying to go through the entire 1930 census manuscript when it first came out in 2002, I guess. And there were 300,000 people in Seattle in 1930, and I actually got seasick from reading the microfilm, and it's since been indexed on a computer. But what I found was that Native people, if they were not sort of, they were sort of clustered in downtown in the poor, rundown districts, or they were sort of spread out in the neighborhoods. And this is the story in the 20th century, is Native people becoming part of the urban story just like anyone else. And so you see people who are pipe fitters living in Interbay, or they work in an oil refinery and they live in Columbia City and so on. And they're just sort of part of everyday urban life. And it's hard to get at what their individual lives were like, but they're part of the city like anyone else.
In what ways were Europeans changed in their interactions with the indigenous people?
That's something that is also really central to this book. It's really tempting to only talk about how the city changed Native peoples, but the reverse was true as well. And settlers, European and otherwise, were really transformed. And there's a couple of different ways. One is that, again, to function in the city, especially in the early decades, you had to come to terms with Native people. And there's a wonderful story of a Chinese man named Ling Fu, who was brought up on charges that he was an illegal immigrant in the 1870s and came before a judge. And the judge said, you know, you're a foreigner, we need to deport you. And he said, no, I was born here. And the judge immediately shifted into Chinook jargon, the trade language of this region, and started talking to the man in Chinook jargon and said, how old are you? What's your name? Where were you born? And Ling Fu says back to him in Chinook jargon, my name is Ling Fu, I'm 25 years old, I was born here. At which point the judge says, oh, sure, you're an American, you belong here, case dismissed. So there's a sense of the way to be here is to know these stories. A sense of belonging in Seattle has often been articulated through stories about Native peoples. And that continues on. You see lots of people in the early 20th century, whether they're pioneers or city promoters, arguing over the nature of the city. Has it become too big and anonymous? Or should we celebrate its new metropolis status? But the way they're having these debates is often by telling stories about Native people, which is really fascinating. So they're being transformed as well.
Would you speak more about the disconnect between symbolic Indians and the real living members of the Indian community?
Yeah. Again, throughout Seattle's history, there's a real tendency, and this is why I start with ghost stories, to only see Native people in cities as metaphors and to focus on the metaphors more than the actual Native lives. And the best example of that is Chief Seattle, who has become such a symbol for Seattle. He is the symbol for Seattle. He's kind of the patron saint, really. And that image of him is quite at odds with his actual life. When he died in 1866, it was not mentioned in any newspapers in the region. But then he gets sort of resuscitated as a symbol. One of the best examples of this is in the 1970s. He gets sort of resuscitated as kind of the noble savage, the proto-environmentalist. And you see it come up again and again in the Seattle Weekly a few years back. They had a big set of articles about transportation in the city, and the cover had an electric car with a Chief Seattle statue sticking out of it, and it said, what would Chief Seattle drive? That's not actually about Native people. That's actually about everyone else. And so Native people again and again are routinely used for their symbolic import, which often goes very much at odds with what's actually happening for real Native people.
Why do these stories matter? How do they affect our actions?
That's a really good question, because that's one of the claims that I make, is that these stories matter. Let me give an example. I mean, the most profound sort of foundation for all of this is this idea that Native peoples and cities cannot coincide. They can't. be together. And I spent a lot of time looking at documents like the planning reports and correspondence of people who built the Lake Washington Ship Canal, for example. And nowhere in any of those documents do they ever mention Native people, even though Native people were being evicted and displaced by the creation of these things. And those Native people were often literally on the front page of the newspapers. There would be these very melodramatic stories about, you know, poor old Billy Phillips. He's starving and, you know, he can't find fish anymore. He's just tragic. So there's this disconnect between the story of progress represented in these documents of the ship canal and then the story of inevitable decline, when in fact they're connected. And so a lot of times in the book I tried to say these things are happening simultaneously. They're the same story. And so this idea of the vanishing red man becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so that's an example of how the stories that people told, oh, these Native people are going to inevitably disappear, somehow allows or justifies an action that then actually causes Native people to disappear in a certain kind of way. So it's a really good example from the early 20th century. And the people building the ship canal, these were people that considered themselves environmentalists. They were improving nature and making it better, which is probably disturbing to a lot of us that are environmentalists now to think that that's what these people thought they were doing.
Could you give an additional example?
Another story from the early 20th century that I think is really interesting is the sort of genre of pioneer writing that comes up, where descendants, mostly of the Denny Party, but other pioneers, start recording their stories as their generation starts sort of dying off, people that had memories of very early Seattle and the founding. And there's this interesting thing that happens where they start to, as a way to sort of critique or lament urban growth and so on, they start telling stories in their writings about Native people and how close we were as pioneers to these Native people, and, you know, our children played with their children, and, you know, and that's all gone and it's all disappeared, and now there's this big anonymous city and now we're kind of like the Indians, we're disappearing too. And there's one pioneer descendant in particular who writes, she remembers when her house burned down in I think the 1880s or something, and she remembers thinking of all the Native people who had been burned out of their homes. And she said, I find myself asking Chad Quidalal, which in the local language means, where is my home? So here's a white pioneer woman lamenting urban growth by speaking the Native language and talking about Native women who were burned out of their homes by her family's contemporaries. So it's one of those weird loopings around that happens again and again in the history. And again, then the Native people are pushed into the symbolic.
Could you say a few words about the American Indians Women's Service League and other mm-hmm. Indian activism from the mid to late 20th century up to now?
Yeah. One of the most well-known events that I'm sure people who are old enough remember is the occupation of Fort Lawton in northwest Seattle, what's now Discovery Park and Daybreak Star Indian Center. The person who sort of became the figurehead for that, or the leader of that, was a man named Bernie White Bear, who was from the Colville tribes. And when that happened in 1970, it got international attention. I think an Italian editor, newspaper editor, called the Seattle Times and said, do you guys have an Indian problem? You know, your forts are being taken over by Indians. And so it was this real flashpoint and got a lot of international attention. But it had its roots much deeper. I talked earlier about Skid Road and sort of this community of Native people in the poorer parts of the city. In the 1950s, a bunch of Native women, many of whom were sort of more middle class, got together and realized they needed to do something for Native people who were having a hard time in the city. And they created a group called the American Indian Women's Service League in, I think, 1958 or 1960 it was founded. And they created the first Indian center in town. This was the first sort of Indian space in the city in a very long time that was really for Native people. And their newsletters are absolutely fascinating because people write in and sort of give testimonials about how much the center means to them. But the newsletter is also, it's very 1950s. These are sort of Cold War housewives, right? And it's recipes and Christmas decoration ideas and this sort of thing. But also, here's what's going on in the Senate and what you need to know about it. Those people had a lot of volunteers that worked for them, and one of them was a young man named Bernie White Bear. And so out of this women's organization grew a new activist generation that was informed by the social movements of the 1960s, 1970s. Eventually, the takeover of Fort Lawton came out of that.
Could you just very briefly comment on the Duwamish and their struggle for recognition as a tribe?
Yeah, this is an ongoing story in Seattle, still happening today. The Duwamish tribe have been, even though they were signatories to the Treaty of Point Elliott, they've been considered not to exist by the federal government since the 1970s. And Since then, their struggle has been to get federal recognition. That's the official term for it. They were finally granted federal recognition on the last day of the Clinton administration. And then on the first day of the Bush administration, it was revoked, which, of course, was a huge slap in the face. And now it's mostly about when papers were not signed. But for a long time, the substantive issue in the recognition case was the government's claim that there was a break in political leadership between 1916 and 1925, where the tribe seemed to disappear and then reconstitute itself. And in fact, when you look at the environmental history of the city, 1916 is when the Lake Washington Ship Canal is completed and the Black River, where a lot of Duwamish people are living, disappears. That's the straightening of the Duwamish River. It's absolute chaos for Native people. And so the Duwamish have made a fairly convincing case that it's the same community, just a different generation. And we'll see what happens. I don't know that the situation looks very good for them. And although they do have a lot of cultural authority in the city, people who pay attention to the city know about them. And right now they're working on building a longhouse, sort of a cultural center. But the recognition story is not over, but it's really tough, I think.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
A couple of things. One, I hope it will encourage people who would listen to a show like this, who maybe think of themselves as environmentally conscious or interested in place and sense of place, sense of belonging, and that's certainly the kind of person I am too, that this would help enrich that sense of place to really get at where are we? What happened here, right? So that's a really important piece to help people figure out where they are, orient them, but also disorient them at the same time. The other thing is that I hope this will encourage other stories to come forward. When I started this project, I thought, I'm just going to write about everything that ever happened to a Native person in Seattle. And it became clear that wasn't going to work. And nobody would want to read that. And so I know I missed tons of stories. And so what I'm hoping is that when I do book readings or through things like this, it will encourage other stories to come out, even ones that contradict mine. And so that we can get this stuff up to the surface again, because it's been sort of subterranean for a really long time.
What's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess I would like to leave them with the idea that this is the most important story in Seattle's past, I think. The transformation of this place so quickly from this really rich, embodied Native landscape that had been here for thousands of years. It was only 150 years ago or so that the city was founded, and how rapidly it's been transformed since then. And then the idea that this history is not over at all. It's still being remade all the time. We find archaeological sites, Native people claim rights to fish, all these sorts of things. This history is not over. And so this is kind of a user's guide to living in Seattle, in a sense. You need to know this stuff affects your life whether you know it or not.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Carl.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We have just been speaking with Carl Thrush, Assistant Professor of History at the University of British Columbia and author of the book Native Seattle, Histories from the Crossing Over Place, published in 2007 by the University of Washington Press. For more information, check on the web at www.washington.edu/UW Press. Again, washington.edu/UW Press. In addition, you are invited to hear Carl Thrush here in Seattle, April the 17th at Pigott Auditorium at Seattle University at 1:30 p.m. There also will be a reading at the University Bookstore on April the 26th at 7 p.m. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.